Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're recording on Tuesday morning. We're going to begin with a poem by Lynn Ekdahl, our favorite political poet, and she has a poem entitled, Hang in There, Fannie Willis. Hang in there, Fannie Willis. Don't let them tear you down. Of course they came to get you. You're the biggest show in town. Your case is so important. It's the one that Trump can't end, as he can the federal cases if elected once again. Your case, already paying off its culprits, cop a plea, was moving up the line of thugs, or so it seemed to me. Nutty Jenna Ellis, Kenneth Chesbro, Sidney Powell decided that their goose is cooked, they best throw in the towel. The hope was that Mark Meadows or Giuliani Rudy would seize their better option and from Donald's clutches flee. In other words, they throw their Don right underneath the bus, thereby salvaging our country and relieving all of us. But the Donald's cohort had, of course, a very different plan, something quite in line with actions that were taken by the Klan. Debase the prosecutor, luckily a woman black. Flaunt her private life in public. It's a bloodthirsty attack. If they can force her off the case will probably die. They're demanding that the judge, the DA, disqualify. So Fannie Willis, stand your ground, make your country proud. You've bravely faced the onslaught of the Donald and his crowd. Lynn Ekdahl, my favorite political poet. She always sends me her stuff. Joining us right now is another favorite. Her name is Amy Littlefield. Amy Littlefield is the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. Fabulous writer. Absolutely has attention to detail. She's kind of like an octopus. She's got all her arms out and she's always pulling in the information. And the more information she pulls in, the more you understand that this is not just a story about Florida. This is not just a story about an abortion. This is really a story that could change the course of political history. And this is such an important state on every level. We know that because we've been doing DeSantis Watch and Florida Watch as long as DeSantis was in the race. And we actually haven't left Florida because we understand it's important too. So Amy's piece was entitled, Will a Florida Ballot Measure to Protect Abortion Shake Up the State's Politics This November? Not only is Florida the last bastion of abortion access in the Southeast, it's a state with the third highest number of electoral votes and a memorable record of swinging presidential elections. With no further ado, let me welcome Amy back to the program. Thank you so much for writing this. I want everyone to pay attention to this story. I want everyone to share this story. And I want everyone to focus on Florida, because maybe more than anything else, Florida could decide the national outcome, let alone the outcome for women. So Amy, welcome back to the program. And tell my audience a little bit about what's happening here. We've been following the idea that they were wanting to get this referendum on the ballot. We are familiar, my audience especially is familiar, because I remember when they had a number of referendums, I believe it was to raise the minimum wage, and I think one was about reinstating ex-felons with the right to vote, and the Floridians, the Republicans thought they were so clever, they were going to raise the percentage you needed to get, like 60%, and they figured, at 60%, they'll never reinstate felons. And then in Florida, of all places, they knocked it out of the park. They got that 60% for ex-felons, they got that 60% for raising the minimum wage. Of course, you know, there was mischief afoot that meant that could you actually have it happen in reality? But if nothing else, you saw that it was an electorate that was engaged, that cared about justice, that understood the franchise, that understood that sometimes while they may be voting for Republicans, they don't always act in your best interest. And that to me is an amazing cocktail of hope for what could happen as a result of this abortion referendum. Share with my audience what you are seeing, what you are hearing, if you have concerns, what they are. But also, I think this is a really hopeful story. And I think we need to look at it as a way, as almost a GPS on how we move forward as we approach the November 2024 election. So welcome back to the program. And thank you for writing this.
It's so great to be back with you, Arnie. Thanks for having me. And thank you for paying such close attention to Florida. So, you know, to recap, you know that I am an evangelist for the power of abortion rights at the ballot box. And in the wake of the Dobbs decision, of course, Kansas was the first indicator. We had, you know, a state that is known as Ruby Red that, you know, voted to uphold abortion rights in the summer after the Dobbs decision. And then we saw the red wave that turned out to be a big pile of nothing. In the 2022 midterms. And so the power of abortion in states from California and Vermont, where you would expect it to do well, to states like Kentucky, where you wouldn't. It's been a full a clean record for abortion rights, since the Dobbs decision. And really, I think this is two factors, right? It's outrage over the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and it's also the fact that there is an electorate that is largely pro-choice that has been underutilized, that has not been invested in, including in deep red states. And so what's really exciting and important about Florida is that we could see a ballot initiative on abortion rights in a state that is pivotal, the third highest number of electoral votes in the country. A lot of us who are old enough to remember the year 2000 have, a little bit of trauma maybe around the association of Florida and election in the same sentence. But as you point out, we have seen progressive ballot measures succeed and flourish there. And Florida is absolutely crucial. I mean, it is impossible to overstate how important Florida is in the landscape of abortion access right now. I mean, the South is basically a funnel, and you have this solid block of states where abortion is banned entirely or at 6 weeks, as is the case in Georgia. And so you have thousands of people each year going to Florida for abortions, 84,000 abortions taking place each year in the state. There's no way that anywhere can absorb that volume of patients. And so, as one organizer told me, it's a moral imperative to fight for this. And also, tactically, it's fascinating, right? To think that Florida could change, because again, I believe in the power of abortion to do the impossible. So
Well,
I am
and
daring to dream
abortion,
on that.
people were outraged and devastated after the Dobbs decision. But there has been such incredible overreach by the Republicans. They are getting more abusive, more controlling. They're out of their mind. And now with the IVF possible decision, where, I guess a hospital by accident threw away some fertilized eggs, and now they're basically claiming it's a life. And there's no stopping them. There's no stopping them. And the consequences are getting so incredible for whether doctors want to actually go to that state, whether young people want to stay in a state. And now we're beginning to realize, even if you're in a ruby blue state, okay, that the consequences of what's happening in red states could actually harm you. You are not protected in your blue state. One, because things may happen nationally. Donald Trump now likes a round number of 16 weeks, and God help us if he wins. But more importantly, you're beginning to see that what's happening in those red states is now beginning to affect and interfere with the activities in blue states. So you are not safe there. There is no protected landscape. So the story of Florida isn't just the story of the referendum, which we need to talk about because now it's been appealed to the Supreme Court and they will make a decision by April 1st. You have to explain to me what the basis of the appeal is. But more importantly, you play out all of Florida, and it's not just about a passing of a referendum. It's about what it could sweep in and suck in as a result, both congressionally, presidentially, as well as legislatively, assuming Democrats know what the hell they're doing. But I'm assuming that they do because, frankly, as a female, I don't give a crap what Democrats do. I know what I need to do. And I'm doing this because it's my future, it's my children, it's the future of this country. And if the Democrats can't figure it out, well, then hell, I'll figure it out. So tell me, it's gone to the Florida Supreme Court. Give me the landscape of the Supreme Court and what the hell is the basis for it being even taken to the Supremes?
Right. I mean, so, Florida is noteworthy in part because it's a Republican supermajority state where the governor, sends asylum seekers to Martha's Vineyard for fun. And it is a state that, Trump won and in 2016 and 2020, but it's also a state that Obama won in 2008 and 2012. And so Florida has an unusually high series of hurdles that need to be cleared in order for anyone to get an issue like this on the ballot. So, Floridians Protecting Freedom, which is the campaign that's trying to enshrine abortion rights until viability into the state constitution, they had to gather almost 900,000 signatures from at least half of the state's 28 congressional districts. They blew through that, even their own expectations. They verified close to 1 million signatures. And then they have to contend with the fact that we have a deeply conservative anti-abortion administration there and court appointments made by those deeply right-wing state officials. So Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody had filed a challenge claiming that the language voters were going to see when they voted was misleading. And, you know, the degree to which the campaign had played this safe, they had I think they had basically copied and pasted the language of the constitutional amendment into the summary that voters were actually going to see. I mean, they were so anticipating that this was going to be picked apart every which way. And they knew also that the Florida Supreme Court, of the seven justices, five of them were appointed by Ron DeSantis, and a sixth one is married to a co-author of the state's six-week ban, which of course is not in effect yet, but could come into effect depending on what the very same Florida Supreme Court rules on the 15-week ban. And so this was sort of a setup, you know, for, you know, expectations were low, let's put it that way. And yet somehow this hearing that was held on the Florida Attorney General's argument that the ballot language was misleading went really well. And, you know, people from the campaign who were sitting in the courtroom were quite pleasantly surprised. Some of the very conservative members of this court seemed ready with some really fiery one-liners. And this hearing, by the way, was on February 7th. We'll get a decision one way or the other by April 1st. You know, the justices were saying things like the people of Florida aren't stupid. They can figure this out. You know, they just were not having the argument that this was misleading. Now, the huge caveat here, Arnie, is that the justices were also sort of forecasting some really scary draconian arguments that they did seem into that could be coming down the line. And so we have to understand that Florida could make history in many different ways. One of them, you know, is preserving abortion access in the South. The other is, you know, potentially having a down ballot impact on, you know, the state legislature. And, you know, if Democrats get mobilized and come out in high numbers, even though this is, you know, of course, the organizers emphasized to me, this is not a partisan measure. This is something they're counting on Republicans. They're counting on unaffiliated voters. And yet we have often seen in states like Michigan that measures like this can energize Democrats who are angry about how Republicans are, you know, like Ron DeSantis, are restricting abortion. So, and the other way that this could make history, and, you know, we have to be thinking long term, is that we could have arguments around anti-abortion pipe dreams like fetal personhood before Florida Supreme Court justices who seem really into some of those ideas. So, you know, a lot to unpack there. But basically, with the responses of the justices at this hearing on February 7th, it seems likely that they may shoot down the Florida Attorney General's argument here and allow this measure to get on the ballot, in
so
which
let me,
case,
let,
yeah.
Right, let me mirror back. So what I'm hearing is that they may open this door, but they can actually shut a bunch of other doors. So you get your vote, but you don't get what you really ultimately want, which is to protect a woman's right to choose. And then as the other thing that I want to remind people of is that April 1st is when they're supposed to decide about the referendum. But there also is something else that's coming down the pike, because before them is whether, I guess, as you pointed out, it's been sitting at the Supreme Court since September, which is the question of whether the state's existing 15-week abortion ban is constitutional. And if the court upholds that ban, then the six-week ban signed by DeSantis would take effect 30 days later. And as you point out, this would be the largest single loss of abortion access in one day after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. It's kind of, again, I feel like the floodgates are opening again. So we've got the 15-week abortion ban. I don't know how they're going to go on that. But if they agree to that, then how do they also agree to the six-week? Is that just automatic? Does that mean that bans are kosher? And once bans are kosher, we accept yes to the 15-week. So by definition, we'll say yes to any other ban. Is that the rationale here?
It has to do with protections of with the reading of Florida's state constitution. And so if the Supreme Court looks at that 15-week ban, which is already in effect in Florida, and says that seems constitutional, we can let that take effect under Florida's constitution, then 30 days later, it would trigger the six-week ban taking effect. And, you know, obviously, we've seen the impacts of a six-week ban before. We saw it in Texas, you know, in the months before the Dobbs decision. It's, you know, catastrophic in terms of people actually being able to get access to abortion. And, when you look at the map and all of the states, to the north and the sort of the rest of the South almost entirely is dark already, it's a pretty scary scenario to think about Florida going dark too. And so I think fighting for abortion access in Florida, as Andrea Mercado, one of the organizers of Florida Rising, told me, is a moral imperative. You know, they have to do it regardless. The question is, does the Democratic Party get interested? Do some of the other big, political power players that now see a potential for abortion in elections like this, do they get interested and invest in Florida? So that, because what we're coming up against, Arnie, and this is a theme you and I have talked about before, is that underinvestment by progressives in local races, in local politics. And that is huge, especially in states like Florida that have been written off, as conservative, states like Texas, states in the Deep South that have been written off as not worth investing in. Well, when it comes to the people who are living in those states, and as Andrea Mercado pointed out to me, more Black women live in the South than anywhere else in the country. More Latina women live in the South than any other part of the country. These are not states that we can just say, oh, let's all make some jokes about Florida and move on.
Please, everyone, share this story. Read this story out loud. Get coffee clutches. I just want to remind everyone again from your article, because we can't reemphasize it enough. Picture the South as a funnel, with a solid block of more than a dozen states sending patients into Florida. In 2023, even the 15-week abortion ban in place, more than 7,000 patients traveled to Florida for abortions from states like Texas and Mississippi, where abortion is banned, and Georgia, where it has a 6-week ban. We see around 84,000 patients a year here, and we are one of only three states that don't have a 6-week ban currently enacted in the entirety of the Southeast. No state could come close to absorbing those 84,000 patients if abortion access in Florida is lost. I want Black men and women, I want Latino men and women to understand this is about you. This is about your future. This is about the people that live there, as you point out, that have the highest concentration. Okay, so now that we have that, there's got to be a campaign. So that was the other aspect of your piece, was who's funding this campaign? Who gets it? And how do we connect the dots to make people understand that this is so much more than abortion? It is so freaking huge on every level. And if there's a reason to focus, this is the campaign that you should get focused on.
Right. I mean, and Arnie, the campaign has raised over $16.8 million so far. They hope to raise $3.3 million in the first quarter of this year. A lot of that money, when you look at their records so far, their financial disclosures, has come from donors and organizations within the state of Florida. And some donors, like the Fairness Project, which is a major backer of progressive ballot initiatives, they like to emphasize that they have a really winning record. They've won 32 of 34 ballot campaigns, and that's on, a host of progressive issues, not just abortion. They're already funding abortion initiatives in Arizona, Missouri, and Montana, but they told Politico recently that they were staying out of Florida, kind of hedging their bets, because they're, quote, the poster child of a very unfriendly state for ballot measures. So again, we see this logic of like, stay out because we might not win, but then how do you change states like Florida over time, right? And so when I spoke with the Fairness Project, last week, they seemed to be sort of reconsidering that decision, said they were going to be diving in with Floridians Protecting Freedom to figure out what their support would look like once it qualifies for the ballot. So again, what's changed here recently is that the responses of the justices during the hearing on February 7th made it seem like, even though this is a very conservative Florida Supreme Court, this may make it to the ballot.
Let me just read one more thing, because there's a trifecta going on in Florida, which is why the Fairness Project, call me, I'll talk you into this. But anyway, one of the things that you point out is it's not lost on the state's Democratic Party that an abortion rights ballot initiative could be a golden opportunity, especially combined with a marijuana legislation initiative that has qualified for the ballot. Well, that's good, but this is the real golden part of the triangle. And whatever Taylor Swift has planned for her three concerts in Miami weeks before the election. God, Taylor, do I love you or what?
Arnie's
It's like, That's like hilarious when you think about it. You couldn't write this into a script. I mean, abortion, marijuana, and Taylor. I mean, what more do you want? You
It's
know,
a
it's
win. I may move
incredible.
to Florida, Arnie. I don't know about
I know.
you.
I know. It's an amazing story, but it also shows an opportunity, and it also says not just to the Fairness Project, but for everyone around the country that cares about women's equality, that cares about the franchise, that's worried about the takeover of fascism, that's worried about all the things that we are worried about going into 2024. It turns out that the epicenter of actual success could be in Florida, but it only can happen if people understand it, make the investment, get the commitment, and people in Florida understand they can't leave their power on the table. They've got to vote. And they're not just voting for themselves, they're not just voting for their children. Frankly, they're voting for a country, Amy. They're voting for me. They're not just voting for them. And I don't know how to impress upon Floridians that's the case, but it's time we do.
Right. And they know that this is about democracy. I mean,
Yeah.
voters, I think voters understand that intuitively, that abortion and democracy are intertwined. And certainly they better understand it in a state like Florida, where we see Ron DeSantis's, election police coming and arresting people, and this crackdown on voting rights. I mean, this is a population that understands that Republicans are trying to restrict their right to vote, and that all of these issues are interconnected and intertwined.
All right, last but not least, now that I'm all on an upside, now let me get myself a little bit sober again. So talk to me a little bit about this personhood stuff. Where does that go? Because that's to me a little bit chilling. So I need to understand it as well because I want to go with my eyes wide open.
Yes, it is chilling. I mean, let's be clear. Personhood, which is the idea that embryos and fetuses are people with equal rights to the person carrying that pregnancy from the moment of fertilization, or this is counting in a petri dish, right? Counting for in vitro fertilization. This could have impacts on IVF, on birth control. This has been the end game since day one. This is not new. This is something the anti-abortion movement wants. They want constitutional rights for the fetus and the embryo. And so what happened is this February 7th hearing, the Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, while he seemed skeptical of the Florida Attorney General's argument that the ballot language on abortion rights was misleading, he was sort of dropping in these random questions about fetal personhood that took even the attorney who was arguing the anti-abortion case for the state, took him aback. He didn't know what to say. He was like, frankly, I haven't thought about this. Mr. Chief Justice, I'm going to have to do my homework on that. And then Liberty Counsel, which is an anti-abortion law firm that was working with the state of Florida on this, went home, did their homework, and came back with a brief listing the sections of Florida law that they say grant legal protection to an unborn child or an unborn person, because they had basically been issued an invitation, from this justice saying, I'd really like to hear your personhood arguments, because that's something I've been thinking about a lot.
And the reason they're thinking about it is, let me read this. The Alabama Supreme Court has ruled to legally recognize frozen embryos as children. However, doctors and legal experts warn the ruling could have dangerous implications for fertility treatments such as vitro fertilization. So they probably are like calling on the So Alabama, let's talk to the Supremes there because this is Florida calling. This is the Supremes here. Let's talk personhood. And so they throw that into this conversation, which is absolutely terrifying. So again, they're going to look to the voters like, look at we're giving you a right of choice, and then they're going to then slam the door because they're going to go to this idea of personhood. So in a lot of ways, what you think you're getting, you may in fact have removed. But that's another reason why you need to have voters changing the nature of Florida politics, whether it's the legislature, whether it's the governor, whether it's members of Congress, because the only way you stop the Florida Supreme Court from coming up with the same thing that Alabama did is by making sure that the politics and the political people that you choose change, because ultimately that's what decides what's on your Supreme Court.
Exactly. And, these personhood arguments, Arnie, they are proof that the anti-abortion side has a long game. And you know what? The long game for progressives has to include investing in states like Florida that, you can't write off, that are essential to abortion access, that are essential to democracy. And so I'm going to be very closely watching what happens there. And I know you are too.
Absolutely. And again, I'm going to be speaking at Harvard tomorrow. And I used to have Bella Abzug's old office when I was a fellow there. And I want to remind everyone, I want to remind especially my progressive base, that you can lose, but you can ultimately win. But you have to learn how to lose and rebuild. Learn how to lose and rebuild. And what Bella Abzug said is you have to lose, lose, lose to win. You don't run away from Texas. You don't run away from Florida. You don't run away from those states. You constantly make an investment. And if you constantly make that investment, Bella was absolutely right. You lose, lose, lose to win. And if there's an opportunity to win in Florida, it is in 2024. But that's going to require focus, investment, courage, courage like Navalny. Only no one's asking you to basically, you know, be killed by Putin. But in a lot of ways, you will be killing democracy if you don't participate. So this is really important. Thank you so much, Amy Littlefield. You're a fabulous writer. Her piece is at The Nation. Share it, read it, share it, read it, and then do something. Will a Florida ballot measure to protect abortion shake up the state's politics this November? Not only is Florida the last bastion of abortion access in the Southeast, it is a state with the third highest number of electoral votes and a memorable record of swinging presidential elections. Again, Amy Littlefield writes for The Nation magazine. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We will be right back.
Let's reflect for a minute on the recent remarks of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan.
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Justice Kagan, during a public conversation at the Library of Congress, avoided saying anything directly relevant to any case before the court. But she did articulate decision-making principles and powerfully shared her perspective on the court discarding precedent. Justice Kagan said, "When the law flip-flops after change in personnel on the court, it doesn't look like law anymore. It looks like a form of politics." She continued, "And I think that's especially important for this Supreme Court at this time. Law should not look like a form of politics where just because the composition of the court changes, a whole batch of legal rules change with it." Justice Kagan added, "When what was once a right is no longer a right because the court is different, I think that's very damaging to the court, very damaging to society." Justice Kagan did not mention any one of the dozens of examples where this Supreme Court has reversed or dramatically changed longstanding law, but as Adam Liptak wrote in the New York Times, it was a good bet that the court's 2022 decision overruling Roe versus Wade was among one of the ones on her mind. And let us add, ours too.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, because freedom can't defend itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss, when you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. Once a month, we reach out to Laura Bellin. She is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for Bleeding Heartland, a community website focusing on Iowa politics. She is also the State House reporter for KHOI Radio in Ames and co-hosts the station's Capital Week program, as well as a member of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. We've been covering Iowa for a long time. Obviously, for like almost 20 years, I hung out with Stefan Schmidt on Iowa Public Radio, let alone on my own show, and we were covering the caucus in the primary. Well, in part, with the caucus losing some of its je ne sais quoi when the Democrats decided to punt, and the Republicans basically have no primary because it's all Donald all the time, so there really is no choice, Iowa, to some extent, felt less important. But in some ways, Laura, I think Iowa has become more important because in a lot of ways, whatever Governor Reynolds does, when you look at Reynolds, DeSantis, and Abbott, you see a trifecta of toxic Republican politics. And they use all their states to sort of experiment in things that I think do harm to public education, do harm to women, do harm to the environment. And they're successful because they have Republican legislatures that actually follow their lead. But the direction they're taking Iowa is actually terrifying. So I welcome you back to your monthly conversation with me. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. But I wanted to start in a place that I think is really important. The place that I think is really important, Laura, is that knowledge is power. Investigative journalists are essential. If you want to fight corruption, if you want to fight apathy, if you want to fight the things, then you need to have really good journalism. It needs to be vibrant. It needs to be curious. It needs to ask the tough questions. So therefore, you want to celebrate people like you who are willing to do this for virtually nothing. I mean, you are committed to doing this, and I applaud you. But what was so shocking was that 5 years ago, you applied for press credentials, and you have all the credentials that should say absolutely yes. And it wasn't until this year that they finally gave you press credentials. So not only welcome back to the program, but explain to my audience, 5 years, like what the heck were they thinking? And why did it take so long? And what did you have to pull in the way of a trigger for them to finally say uncle and award you the press credentials? Anyway, welcome back to the program, Laura.
Thanks so much, Arnie. And I should say that although in the past I have written about the Iowa caucuses and presidential campaigns, I am really much more passionate about state government and state legislative coverage. I feel that that's where I can add the most value. And I think it's important because what state legislatures do really affects people's lives. And so it's always been a high priority for me. I've been writing about Iowa politics since the late 2000s, but the state legislative coverage has always been very important to me. But I didn't apply for press credentials until 2019, because when I started my website, my kids were young and I didn't have as much time to be down at the State House. But a few things changed and I decided to apply in 2019. And honestly, I never thought I would have any trouble, even though there was a Republican trifecta. I guess that's how naive I was. I knew that a lot of the Republican legislators read my work and still read my work. And so I was really shocked when I was denied in the Iowa House. And although the Senate didn't officially deny me, they also didn't seat me. So at the time, I mean, the Iowa House did not even have any kind of a written policy on media credentialing at all until about 4 to 6 weeks after rejecting me for the first time. Then they came up with a policy. I argued that I met the terms of the policy and they still denied me. And then this happened year after year. They actually changed the policy a couple of times every time I kept demonstrating that I met the terms of the policy. And what changed this year is that the Institute for Free Speech, which is a national organization based in Washington, they filed a federal lawsuit on my behalf saying that this was an infringement on my press freedom and my free speech to be denied, even though I met the qualifications. I was similarly situated to the other reporters who had access. So after this 5-year saga of trying to get credentialed, within 5 days after we filed the lawsuit, the Iowa House chief clerk offered me a seat. So I do now have a seat on the press bench in the Iowa House, and I am able to cover debate on equal footing with the other reporters who are down there.
So before I have you continue on the rest of the conversation we're going to have is, did they explain their come to Jesus moment? I mean, did they say, well, because of the lawsuit, or did they say that we reviewed our qualifications and we suddenly realized, oh, yes, you actually meet those qualifications? I mean, did they just say anything, or did they just issue your press credentials?
Well, they never gave me a reason before. Before, I always just got the vague denials that upon review, you don't meet the terms of our policy. And then when I would respond and say, which part of it do you think that I don't meet? And here's why A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I do meet it. There was never any response. So what happened, there was no real explanation. I just suddenly received an email that said, upon review, you do meet the qualifications. So, God. and a seat was set aside for me on the press bench. So I never really had an explanation. I mean, that was part of the issue with our lawsuit, as the court filing went into detail in my declaration, is that I could never get a specific reason for why I was being denied.
I love this story. I think it serves like a mini documentary. All right, let's get into what's going on in Iowa. Mazel tov, congratulations, by the way. And you write, abortion regulations in Iowa. The State Board of Medicine approved revised rules that would provide guidance to doctors if the Iowa Supreme Court allows the state to enforce the near total abortion ban. And what we're talking about is something that we've been talking about with other states and other places. The idea is exceptions. What do they mean by an exception? And I keep saying, whenever you see an exception in an abortion ban, you know it's not, you know, because it's so confusing, it's so obtuse, it gives no one guidance, and therefore everyone's afraid to touch the patient because the doctors are afraid that they're not going to interpret it as a legitimate exception. The patient needs to figure out what to do, and usually they flee the state, as you saw that took place in places like Texas. So tell me about what's going on with this attempt to get some kind of revised rules and guidance.
So first, I just want to give people the view from 30,000 feet. Abortion remains legal in Iowa right now up to 20 weeks. We have a 20-week abortion ban that was passed in 2017. Last summer, our state legislature passed and our governor signed a near total ban. They call it by the misnomer, the heartbeat bill. That's not a term that I use in my reporting. But in any case, they signed that into law. It was immediately challenged by Planned Parenthood, and it has been enjoined by court order, and the state has appealed that decision. So we're all waiting for the Iowa Supreme Court to decide whether to let that law go into effect, or whether to let litigation proceed, or whether to just rule right away on whether it's constitutional or not. So that's the context. But although the law is enjoined, the Iowa Board of Medicine, which would be charged with enforcing the ban, this is in Iowa, they didn't pass the ban to have criminal penalties for doctors or women getting abortions. It would be discipline, professional discipline that would be administered by the Board of Medicine. So they said the Board of Medicine can go ahead and adopt these rules. And then if the law ever goes into effect, this is what would govern the doctors. So they would know whether they can terminate a pregnancy in case of rape, incest, fetal abnormality, or medical emergency. And as you say, I mean, the thing about exceptions and abortion bans is they're almost written to be as inaccessible as possible. I mean, the rape, to take advantage of the rape exception, you would have to have show that you had reported the sexual assault within 45 days of it occurring. Of course, that would be before many people know they're pregnant. The incest exemption, there is a longer time period that could be reported within 140 days. But there are all these stipulations about, you know, things that would qualify as incest. And as we know, many children who are sexually abused, it might not be by a relative. It might be by an intimate partner of a parent who's not a relative. It might be a neighbor or a coach, a babysitter, right? So we don't, none of those types of sexual assaults would be covered by the incest exception. And then if it were sexual assaults, we know it would be rape, but that would not qualify either for the exception because that would have to be reported within 45 days. So, I mean, these exceptions are really unworkable. And so the Board of Medicine, I mean, they did make, this was a revision to the rules as they were first presented in November. They made some slight improvements to the ultrasound language to make it more resembling like a medical procedure that a doctor would really order. But it still requires doctors to gather lots of information. Like, for instance, if you were going to terminate a pregnancy because of a rape, you would have to find out when this sexual act happened and who the, I mean, this is not, the victim might not even know, right? And they, or they might not want to tell you. And it's not the type of question that a doctor would normally ask. And as for the fetal abnormalities, the doctor has to go through all these procedures and sign a form and keep it in the file that says, this is incompatible with life. Well, what does incompatible with life mean? Does that, because some conditions are fatal, but maybe the baby survives for a few hours or a few days after birth or a few minutes even. Is that incompatible with life? Some conditions might be fatal 95% of the time, but maybe, you know, a few, in very rare cases, someone can survive. So a doctor is going to be very afraid, basically, to use that exception because they're going to be worried that they could be brought up and their whole career could be ended. And by the way, our Board of Medicine is entirely appointed by our Republican Governor Kim Reynolds.
Oh, how convenient. I want to go back to what we originally were talking about, which is rape. So I thought I would just remind everyone a little bit about rape and rape statistics. Rape is the most underreported crime. Can I repeat that? the most underreported crime. 63% of sexual assaults are never reported to police. Only 12% of child sexual abuse is reported to authorities. So let's take the reality of rape, you know, in front of us as we have the rape exception. So it is traumatizing. Sometimes you don't even know it. When it's a situation of child abuse, you know, it's again, fingering a relative. I mean, think about all these things that are basically going to undermine someone's ability to sort of, you know, blame someone, say you were raped, and then try to get an abortion and make sure you fit into the exception. So again, this is why it is so terrifying, because it doesn't match what, you know, what is the reality of how we live our lives and how we actually both understand what's happening to our body and who did it to us. It gets me so upset.
It's so important. And I also just want to add that I reject the premise that the only people who should have a choice in whether to continue a pregnancy are people who were violently attacked. I mean, there are countless reasons why somebody should be able to control their own future. And if you saw, there was an absolutely devastating article, ProPublica followed a family in Tennessee.
Oh, the pictures.
A year after being denied an abortion, and how devastating that was. People have all kinds of reasons for needing to be able to live their lives and not being forced to continue a pregnancy. And so this law, this Iowa law, if it's allowed to go into effect, that has nothing. I mean, if continuing the pregnancy would keep you trapped in an abusive relationship, if it would risk your recovery, if it would derail your career, your education, if it would make you unable to provide for the children you already have, none of that counts for anything, right? Those aren't even remotely theoretical exceptions to this law. So there are very narrowly defined exceptions. And a Planned Parenthood in Iowa has estimated that this law would prohibit 98% of abortions. And I mean, I almost wonder if that's a conservative estimate.
Has anyone brought up on the floor of the Iowa legislature about the responsibility of men? Like, now that we're doing all this and we're making it very difficult for women to be able to make that choice, what about male responsibility? Has that kicked in? What about healthcare responsibility? Has that kicked in? What about childcare responsibility? Has that kicked in? What about the ProPublica thing is, these two people they had addiction problems and they were forced to have another child. And so that wasn't that they were clean. They already knew, and that this just added another burden to what they were going to do. I mean, the consequences of bearing a child when the child makes no sense from all this conga line of issues means that society is going to be paying for something where everyone knew it made no sense. Everyone knew that there was no support system in place, that it was bad for the family, bad for the child. And yet all that bad didn't matter because they needed to win. They needed to control. And that's what's so terrifying.
This did come up during the special legislative session last July. A number of Democrats raised this issue during the debate. And one woman said, Eleanor Levin, she said, "I have fewer rights under this bill than a corpse." Literally, in Iowa, there are things you cannot do with a corpse without written consent. I mean, you couldn't force somebody to donate blood. You couldn't force somebody to donate an organ. And yet I could be forced to continue a pregnancy. And there was actually another legislator, Bob Kresig. He said, you know, the last time I checked, I think it takes a man and a woman to create a baby. And yet this bill is all about the vagina, and it just left the penis by the side of the road.
I'm going to use that phrase. Anyway, all right. Well, now that we've gotten through the abortion, we can probably talk about that for an entire hour. Let's talk a little bit about the anti-LGBTQ bills that are remaining alive in the Iowa legislature. We're seeing that happening everywhere. And if it's horrific for gay folks, if you are trans, they're trying to erase your existence, even sort of out of the realm of being possible. So what is happening in Iowa?
So last year was the absolute worst legislative session in history for LGBTQ Iowans. The legislature passed a ban on gender-affirming care for minors, a school bathroom bill, various rules, don't say gay or trans for grades K through six in school, book bans in school that were very much geared toward marginalized authors, books with LGBTQ themes. And that's not all. Those are just the main highlights, right? So this year, some people were thinking maybe the legislature is going to take a break from attacking trans Iowans. Of course, that didn't happen. So there was one bill that failed that would have removed gender identity as a protected class under the Iowa Civil Rights Act. That was like a rare bit of good news coming out of the Iowa House. That bill failed to advance. But our governor, Kim Reynolds, introduced a bill that she claims is about protecting women, right? It defines man, woman, male, female, mother, father in very exclusionary ways, basically denying transgender existence. There would be trans people under her original bill, they would have had to have on their driver's license it would have to show the sex assigned at birth as well as their current sex designation. That was amended out of committee, but the bill still would require trans Iowans to have a birth certificate that shows the sex assigned at birth as well as the current sex designation. It would it would basically be a backdoor way to a state bathroom bill. It would the governor ironically has talked about protecting women in violence shelters. Well, the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence are very against this bill. They say our service providers are already serving diverse populations. This is not going to make anyone any safer. But that bill has gotten through a committee. It is eligible for debate. There are other bills that are not specific to LGBTQ Iowans, but for instance, we have our version of what they call a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is really just a right to discriminate bill that wouldn't only affect LGBTQ, but it would say that businesses could basically claim a conscience right to refuse to treat people. And there's also another bill that would create a very broad medical conscience exemption to providing various sorts of care, which could affect reproductive rights, but could also affect medical care that LGBTQ people receive.
All right. So I've heard about this, but a number of states are rejecting the federal funds to feed kids during the summer. And Iowa is going to be one of those states. And I want to remind everyone that I remember during the pandemic, and you may not know this story, but during the pandemic, schools were shut down. What the mayor of New York City realized was that schools fed kids. So when you shut down schools, it's not that learning's not happening, but the kids are not getting breakfast or lunch because a lot of these kids. So what did the mayor do? He opened schools up for anyone to get breakfast or lunch, which is unbelievable. Now that's one extreme. Now let's go into what's happening in Iowa, because in Iowa, my understanding is that there are federal funds to support children during the summer when they can't access food, which they would be able to access during the school year. But during the summer, when they're off, they still get hungry. They still need lunch. They on occasion probably may even need breakfast. I don't know if you provide that in Iowa. But the governor has decided that even though federal funds are being made available, that they will reject those funds. What the hell for? Why is she saying no to this? I mean, who wins with this? Who wins? Except that she gets to say, see what I stopped. And I'm saying stop for what purpose?
I mean, nobody wins. This is the thing that is so outlandish about this policy. The Reynolds administration announced this a few days before Christmas. So this program, it's a USDA program called Summer EBT. It would go to families that qualify for free or reduced price school lunch. They would get $40 per child per month over the summer that they could use for food. It would come on an electronic benefits card that they could use at any grocery store or farmer's market. Okay, so it would go to an estimated 240,000 Iowa kids, and everybody benefits from it because, as you probably know from food assistance, it's one of the best economic multipliers. People who get this money spend it immediately. They spend it on stores in their local communities, right? So the governor says, oh, this is a pandemic era program and it never was intended to be permanent. Well, she's using lots of pandemic funds. She's using American Rescue Plan money to send our state troopers down to Texas. She's spending it on TV ads to promote tourism to Iowa. And yet money that the federal government set aside, we're talking about $29 million that would help feed 240,000 kids. And the Democrats in the Iowa House and Senate had introduced legislation hoping the legislature would pressure the governor on this issue. Of course, the Republicans didn't even give these bills a committee hearing. So no to feeding hungry kids. And as you say, who wins? Really, nobody wins. That's the thing.
If I were a grocery store owner, right, if I were a farmer's market owner, I'd be like, you are denying me the $40 that would go into my grocery store. You're denying me the $40 that would go to the farmer's market. This money isn't sat on. Money goes into the economy. I mean, I don't even get it.
And because go on.
The
grocery store chains, I do think that they are partly at fault. They have not engaged on this issue or on food assistance generally. You know, for decades, the Farm Bill Compromise, right, that you combine nutrition programs with agriculture subsidies, and the grocery stores were a big lobby in favor of that. We have seen the grocery stores absolutely pull away from that political battle, and it's true in Iowa as well. Now, I would think that if I'm a grocery store owner, I would really want this money coming in, but they didn't register on the bill. They didn't weigh in with the governor's office. They didn't make any public statement during this controversy.
Okay, last but not least, I did hear a rumor, and you have to confirm or reject, that one of the things that Governor Reynolds, your governor, suggested, which is why they didn't need this money for the summer food program, was an issue of obesity challenging Iowans. Now, is that, did she actually use the word obesity?
There was a press release that went out. This is the press release that came out right before the holidays. And it said, she said basically that these don't do anything to help when there's, when we have a rising childhood obesity. They also did say, she said an EBT card does nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic. And many people noted the irony that this is someone who during the pandemic herself said, trust parents. So she was against mask mandates. She was against vaccine mandates. We have to trust people to make their own decisions. But apparently she doesn't trust parents to buy food for their own kids. But they also, they have said, we're going to spend money on expanding existing meal programs, which are not bad, right? It's good to set up some meal sites in school buildings or public parks during the summer, but those don't reach everybody, right? Not every kid has access. They don't have transportation. The parents might be working. They might not be able to get to a site to pick up the meals. And so that's why this summer EBT program was so helpful, because it would have gone to 100% of the kids who need it. And one of the Democrats who represents the city of Dubuque pointed out that in Dubuque, the Boys and Girls Club operate one of these summer meal sites for needy kids. And it's good, but it only serves about 15% of the kids who would qualify for free or reduced price lunch. So it's certainly not an either or situation. We should be doing both and.
Well, and I want to go to the obesity thing, because it still makes me crazy that she would even open her mouth and suggest that. But I remind everyone, isn't corn like a big thing that you do in Iowa? And don't we know about what happens with corn syrup? I'm laughing because if anything is, you know, you can connect the dots between obesity and corn, and it's not because they're eating ears of corn either. It's because of the sugar that is created by that. There's an irony here, but more importantly, let me remind you, it is more expensive to buy maybe a pound of beets than it is to buy a box of Twinkies. Mm-hmm. Now, a pound of beets is probably better for you. So if you had $40 and you were able to sort of, you know, stretch it out, you might be able to actually buy healthier food. But without that $40, you end up buying things that are more empty calories, cereal that's empty. You know, you look at sugared cereal is actually cheaper than cereal without sugar. Why is that? Why is that? And yet when you are triaging your dollars, you buy what you can afford. And sometimes what you can't afford is actually quality food. And that is only aided and abetted by the decision of your governor.
And people, the Iowa Hunger Coalition, which represents food banks and other agencies, they said almost exactly that. I mean, this is, if you want people to eat healthier food, give them more resources to buy healthier food. I mean, it's just, there's no correlation at all between depriving kids of assistance during the summer and somehow that'll make them thinner. It was so offensive. I just don't even know what else to say about it.
Well, I'm glad you said something, because I wanted everyone to hear that that was part of the rationale. Really quickly, Senator Chuck Grassley is unrepentant, even after bribery allegations he promoted last year turned out to be, what, fabrications? Tell me, what did Grassley do?
So the Justice Department last week, you may have heard, they indicted an FBI informant, Alexander Smirnoff. He was at the center. If anyone's heard the allegations about bribery involving the Biden family, it originally came from this story that he reported to his FBI handler in 2020 that was memorialized in a memo that the Senator Grassley released to the public last summer. And Senator Grassley is now trying to say, oh, I forced the FBI to do a real investigation and due diligence on this. No, you didn't. They looked into it in 2020. They found it wasn't credible. They closed the case. He publicized this thing last summer. They went back to this guy. They asked him more questions. There's no evidence. There's still no evidence to back up what he said. And so they indicted him for making false statements and helping to fabricate a document. But Senator Grassley won't admit that there was nothing to this and that that there's no evidence of Biden family corruption like he always enjoys talking
about. So has Grassley really gone downhill? I don't remember him being ever. I mean, he was a little more rational, as I recall, 10 or 15 years ago. And I just feel like not only has he drunk the Kool-Aid, but in some ways he's almost gone beyond that. And it just seems so out of form for what he has been historically. I mean, he's been there since dirt. So it's not like, you know, he's new to the game, but it seems like, I know, is what has happened to him? Or is it just the whole MAGA thing? And you don't even realize that you're going down this incredible slippery slope and losing anything that resembles integrity.
The change really happened during Barack Obama's presidency. I mean, he was genuinely, he did a lot of bipartisan work, especially during the Reagan administration, and held them accountable. But during the Obama presidency, he became very, very partisan. And holding up, not giving a hearing to Merrick Garland was just one of many examples of that. And then during the MAGA movement in the Trump presidency, I mean, he got completely on the train. And he could have been the elder statesman who was really holding Donald Trump accountable. And instead, I mean, he's done his best. He's used his position and oversight just to try to promote Republican narratives. And it is very sad to see.
Laura Bellin is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for Bleeding Heartland, a community website focused on Iowa politics. We get to grab her once a month, and aren't we excited that we do? Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You just